I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today we are rounding out National Poetry Month with The Stacks Book Club episode. Hala Alyan has returned to talk about the award-winning poetry collection, The January Children, by Sudanese-American poet Safia El-Hilo. The title takes its name from the generation of people born in the Sudan under British occupation who were all assigned the same January 1st birthday. Today, Hala and I dig into these poems and discuss what makes them special and also how we should be reading poetry. Make sure to listen through to the end of today's episode to hear what our May Book Club pick will be. And reminder, everything we talk about on each episode of The Stacks can be found in the link in the show notes. There are now 2 ways you can support The Stacks. One is The Stacks Pack, of course, which is over on Patreon at patreon.com/thestacks. The other place is on Substack. I've got a brand new Substack. It's called Unstacked. Both places allow you to get bonus episodes of the show and inside access to The Stacks for only $5 a month. And they both make this show possible. And yes, you can join both. So if you want inside access to the show, a community of readers, then you should definitely head to patreon.com/thestacks. If you're more interested in my hot takes, you want to go to tracythomas.substack.com. Again, both places make it possible for me to make this podcast. So if you love The Stacks, consider joining one of these or both of these communities. Oh, and a fun perk of The Stacks Pack on Patreon is getting a shout out on this podcast. So here you go. Here are some of our newest members of The Stacks Pack: Kyle, Miriam Dillikian, Rob Brettauer, Stephen Kellogg, Shelley Clark, Margaret Govia, Michael Lai, and Rebecca Asmo. Thank you to the entire Stacks Pack, everyone over on Unstacked, and our newest members. And now it is time for my conversation with Hala Alyan about The January Children by Safia El-Hilo. All right, everybody, it is the Stacks Book Club Day. First of all, just want to let people know, this book is our 101st book club pick. Yeah, March was our 100th book club pick. This is our 101st. I can't believe it. And the book is The January Children by Safia El-Hilo. And we're joined again by Hala Alyan. Hala, welcome back to The Stacks.
Hello.
We're talking poetry. I told you this before. I tell everyone this. I'm bad at poetry, but I'm getting better. I feel like I'm finally kind of like, okay, I see what's happening here. I still don't get a lot, but I think I'm getting smarter. I feel like I'm really growing this muscle.
Okay, let me ask you, what did you get? what did you get?
Okay.
Or like, if you had to like elevator pitch me this book.
Okay. I would say this is a book by a Sudanese American person who is thinking a lot about the way that language, borders, home sort of play into each other in her experience, because she feels like she's sort of torn between these places, between Arabic and English, between Sudan and Maryland. And I would also say this book is a cultural criticism on celebrity culture, and I love it because all the poems about the musician.
Abdul Halim Hafiz,
yes. The Egyptian singer who apparently is some sort of a heartthrob, and I love this for me and him.
He's kind of a hottie, and he also, yes, like would address the like Asmarani, which is kind of a, you know, like a an Arabic term of, I mean, quotation mark, endearment to like dark-skinned people, dark-skinned women in particular. Yeah, so she plays around a lot with that.
Okay. How did I do? Do you think that I got...
You did great. Okay. Yeah, I completely agree.
I feel like I did it.
Yeah, she's playing with displacement. She's playing with like, yeah, like border crossing. She's playing with how to like inhabit these different worlds at the same time and how contradictory they are.
Yeah.
You know, like Safia is someone who I recommend people go and look at her. She won an Arab Book Award, Arab American Book Award for one of her collections. It might have been this one.
I think it was this one.
And she has a really beautiful speech about it, about how she like, you know, the reasons in which she does not identify as Arab and the reasons in which her, like how like Arab spaces have not made room for blackness. And so I think she like that speech is like, I really recommend people check that out.
We will definitely link that in the show notes. So we usually start here, which is, what did you think kind of generally of the collection?
I think it's beautiful. I mean, Safia, look, I gotta like, you know, like when you have to sort of just speak your like biases or whatever, like, Safia's a friend of mine. Okay. So I'm like, I also just am obsessed with her as a person, but I knew her as a poet before I ever met her. And so I can say with confidence that like, I know that I love her writing outside of like who she is as a person. Like her writing, I think, is so, so beautiful. She also is someone who got her start in the slam world, like slam poetry world. And you can tell in this really beautiful, like she does this thing where she is like a very serious capital P poet. And that's not to say slam poets aren't, but I'm just saying like she both is like someone who I think is very rigorous and conscious of like the real estate of the page and how it's used up and how, you know, like she, remember how we were talking during my episode, I was saying like, I am not a great, like I'm not great at line breaks. I'm not great at whatever. Like she, I think she, I feel like she's someone who is like put some thought in like when a sentence is going to end, you know, and where you're going to place like a dash or where you're going to place an end dash or whatever. And also is able to retain the sort of like melody and tune and like rhythm that often comes with like people who have some sort of experience with slam poetry. So it's like, it's just a, it's a delightful book to read on the page. And I have, because I've taught it in class before, it's also a really delightful book to read aloud.
Yeah. So I told you this before, you know, I have a background in theater, and I every time we do a poetry episode, I say this, so sorry, everyone, but I studied Shakespeare. And one of the things with Shakespeare, obviously, is the meter and reading it out loud, and the line breaks like mean something. And so every time that I approach a poetry collection, the form is feels very instructive to me. And sometimes when I'm reading a poem out loud, which I often do, or at least like kind of like whispering it under my breath a little bit, I think to myself, I don't think that this writer has thought about the words on the page as instructions to the reader. And in reading this collection, I felt that Safia was thinking about that. Like the lines felt nice to read out loud. They felt like they ended in places that made sense to me. They were playing with language in ways that like felt good coming out of my mouth. Like I wasn't stumbling on words in the way that sometimes I think when people only think about their poems on the page and they're thinking of it like as a visual thing and not necessarily like an auditory thing. But I really felt like this collection, I could sense that. And one of the things we've also talked about is like, I, even if I don't know what the poet's trying to tell me to do, I usually think that like formal elements are some sort of instruction to do something. So like, for example,
You have in your book, you have the poem that has like the double slashes in between. And so I decided to take a breath every single time. So it was like a really panting kind of, because there's like a lot of slashes. And I was like hyperventilating, you know, like a little bit. And I felt like it was fun to do that with Safia's collection too, because I felt like any choice I made, I could sort of justify because she 100%. Was thinking about me reading the book aloud in some way.
I was just going to say, exactly. And to your point, that's not always the case.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I think a lot of poets probably spend a lot of time agonizing over where to place a comma or where to place a word or what, you know, and like not so much time of like, how is it going to be read aloud and how are you going to cue the reader to do it in a way that becomes coherent.
Yeah. And I guess in full disclosure, I once sat next to Safia at an event and she was lovely.
Ooh.
But I don't know her. And so I don't feel like the same. She's not my friend, but I did sit next to her and she was lovely.
She's really
and she dresses she very, very cute.
Kind. And she reads beautifully.
Yeah.
She reads in this like I think a lot of people who have done slam work will like they come on stage and they just fucking envelop. They're like in there. Energy is like radiating. They come in hot. And she does this really interesting thing in performance where her voice gets so low and so melodic and so hypnotic. And she just commands the room with this like quiet power. And it's beautiful to watch.
Yeah. Okay. I got to find some videos of her performing.
Yeah. It's lovely.
Yeah. I also read some, not all of her Girls Never Die. Is that what it's called?
Yes. Also an excellent book.
So this was my second kind of foray into her work, which was interesting because the poems do feel really different. Like this felt really different to me. Like she was, I think part of what I liked about this collection is that because it's a debut, it did feel a little bit more accessible because I felt like I could like hang with her in some places. Yes,
I totally get that. Yeah.
I feel like the more poets do, the harder their shit gets.
I think that's right. Because they're like challenging themselves. Yeah. They're going on a
I think that's true for most artists. Like your first thing, even if it's great, like even if you're Toni Morrison and it's The Bluest Eye, like that is not as complicated as Beloved. And in The Bluest Eye, 100%, yeah, exactly, 100%, exactly. Yeah. Let's talk about language again. Because I think, before we do that, did you read the foreword in this book by Kwame Dawes?
Yes.
What did you think about it?
I thought it was very beautiful. I mean, I haven't read it in a while, but I think like it's very, it's one of the things that my class and I like worked on a few years ago. I think one of the things that they do is they're able to sort of really track, like a lot of the foreword is about the Abdul Halim Hafiz and like, you know, like how he functions as I think like Kwame describes it as an imaginative construct, a source of fantasy that is sensual, yes, but that is profoundly related to her sense of identity. I thought it was good. I mean, I thought it was like really like it dove pretty deeply into all the different things that she's touching upon in the poems. What did you think of it?
Well, I'm not used to poetry having a foreword. And so sometimes when I read books, I don't read the foreword if it's by someone else because I feel like it's a spoiler. Like if you go back and like read forewords on like classic literature, they tell you the ending just like, leave me alone. But I did read this because I thought it might give me clues. And I certainly think that it did give me clues, but I almost think it gave me too much information. I sort of think they got in my way a little bit. And I wish that perhaps it was at the end after I had time with the collection. I didn't dislike it. Like I thought it was nice, but it was also really long. There's only like 30 poems in here.
It was extremely long. She had won a prize. So I think that's like, it was like it's like the African Poetry Book Series. So she'd won the first book prize for African poets.
And so they redid it and put it in.
So I think that's why because usually, you don't like, or rather it was published because it had won a prize.
And
like usually there's no, of course there's no forward. But I think in this case, because she had won, she was like the one that was selected.
Yeah.
Like whoever was, I don't know if Kwame was the judge, but I'm guessing they were the judge. And so in that case, it would make sense that they were the one that got like right about it.
How do you judge poetry?
I mean, I've judged poetry before. Like I've done like little like judge slots. It's very, maybe this will make people feel better because if they've like submitted and not gotten stuff selected, which by the way, I have definitely submitted and not gotten stuff selected for many things. It's so dependent on what you like.
Yeah.
So like the judge is going to pick a book that the judge resonates with, and that's it. They're not going to pick the best book, like capital B, like objective best. They're not going to pick the most powerful. You know what I mean? Like that's not what's going to happen. They're going to pick the book that they enjoy the most. Right. And there's no way, like, I don't know how to how to make the process more objective actually.
Yeah.
When I've done it, I'm like, yeah, I'm moved by this. And so I like this and that's it. I don't know how to explain too much why I'm moved by it, except that I like it.
I judged a nonfiction prize for the LA Times this past year, but it was a specific category. And so it felt like there were parameters. But I think a lot of times with like poetry, it's just like best poetry collection. And I'm like, poetry's less of a genre and more of a medium, like sort of like could be about anything. Some poems are fiction. Some poems are autobiographical. Like some poems are about a place. Some poems are about all humans on the face of the earth. Some poems are about dolphins. Like it's just like how do you narrow it down?
So accurate where it's like it's kind of impossible to be able to know or to speak to exactly what it is that you're like. I mean, like, because to your point, it's going to be it's going to be like, are you moved by the content of the poem? Because someone could submit a absolutely gorgeous, kind of technically perfect or beautiful metered like series of poems. And if it's about something that you're not like, if it's about, I'll speak for myself, baseball,
right?
You know what I mean? I don't know how pulled in I'm going to be on the subject matter.
Right.
You give me a book about like borders and displacement and what, like kind of like this one, and I'm probably going to be like immediately hooked in.
Yeah. And I also think with poems, like, and we've talked about this before, a collection of poetry, if I like 10 poems out of a collection, I'm like, this is the best poetry collection that was ever written. It's not like a novel
where
I'm like, I need to like the whole thing generally. Like you could like 3 or 4 poems that really hit you and you could be like, this collection is the most important poetry collection of my life. And you could hate just as many poems. And so I feel like that's hard too. Like when you think about a poetry prize, I'm like, how did you pick 10 books for this long list? Like there's so many.
I have no idea. I mean, there's also, I think that it's funny you say that because I think sometimes that's by design that you want to publish a book that has some like, not duds, but like, I mean, like with poetry, it's like you want to publish, you can't try to make them all 10 out of 10.
Right. Sure.
Then that would kind of be an exhausting book in its own way.
But your 10 you know could be mean? My like, 5 anyways.
Exactly.
Like
exactly.
One of that's the duds you put in your poetry collection is probably my favorite poem because I'm an idiot and it's like the most accessible. And you're like A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And I'm like, yes, I know the alphabet. It's a banger. And you're like doing all this other shit. And I'm like, it was a haiku and I knew all the words.
It leaves me unmoved. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's actually a very good point. Right. Like that you get like such a range and like what I think it's always funny to me what a poet's favorite I always like to think about like what their favorite poems in their books are, you know what I mean? Or the ones they believe are the best or the most accomplished and like how often to your point that doesn't actually even match up with like readers.
Okay. Wait, now I have to know what your favorite poem is in your new collection. I'm going to see if it's one of mine.
It might be one of the interactive fiction ones, maybe Interactive Fiction House Saints. It's actually the one that opens the book.
Okay.
Cause that was the first one that I wrote from like of this type and I think of like of this form, and I remember just feeling like a real sense of accomplishment because again it's like you're publishing like, or rather you're writing like 10 poems,
right? I think my favorite was Spoiler, the last one. I just love the last line.
I also
so
like
much
Spoiler. I forgot about Spoiler. I also like Spoiler,
the last line, so good. And I liked Boar on 58.
Boar is also
but these are very straightforward poems. These are just like, here are lines.
Well, you like the narrative ones, right?
I do.
You like the ones that are telling the story. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Like mm-hmm. not like they're not like they're not too like obfuscating what's happening.
Yeah. And then I think I stopped writing down all the guzzles that I liked because I liked them so much.
I have really enjoyed the guzzles. I've enjoyed like writing them and I enjoy reading them.
And I like form. Form is so interesting. Like I like when poets have to be even more put in a box than just like a few words. Like I really
just
like
to see what
happens. I'm like, oh, you got to use this word a bunch. How are you going to use it? Back to Safia's book. So you mentioned this, I think on the first episode, about how you can speak Arabic, but you write and read at like a second grader's level.
Yes.
And one of the things, and also a guest we had previously, also Sudanese, Elamine Abdul-Mahmoud, when he came on, he talks about that also in his memoir about like being able to speak, but not being able to read or write like at an adult level.
Right.
And I think Safia is really getting at that same thing here.
100%.
That like this, there's a, and I guess my assumption is that because I don't read or speak or write Arabic,
right.
that because Arabic is a pretty complicated language on the page, that you can have that ability and not be like, you can speak but not write. Also,
yeah. I mean, there's also just, there's kind of two different era, like, so there's a lot of dialects, first of all, but there's also the, there's something called formal Arabic or Fusha. Uh-huh. And that Arabic is the one that's kind of the standardized Arabic. That's the Arabic that all Arabic speaking countries use for like newspapers or news reports or whatever, or like, you know, education or whatnot. And that Arabic is virtually unrecognizable from spoken Arabic in like, for me, like it was like Levantine Arabic. So the Arabic that's spoken in like Lebanon and Palestine and Syria, like that's the Arabic that I speak. Like, you know, it's, I mean, it's not like completely unrecognizable, but like a lot of the words are different. So like words for, you know, like commonplace items are different, or the way that you structure a sentence is different. So it's like not just that you would need to know the alphabet. I know the alphabet. I can like sound out a word, but it's like even once you sound it out, that word might mean something completely different than what you usually associate with that thing.
And that's like what she talks about in her poem Vocabulary, where it's like the Arabic word for hawa means wind. The Arabic word for hawa means love. And so she's talking about, you know, you left me holding wind in my hands, or you left me holding love in my hands. And so that there's like, I mean, that stuff is.
Yeah, like different words can mean so many different things. Yeah, there's such, and I think like Arabic is also such an incredibly poetic, like just, oof. I'm trying to find that one because it's also
on page
just
two.
Like, hawa, hawa. And so if you see, if you look at the Arabic word next to it, like the Arabic writing, do you see how it's just slightly different?
Slightly different.
Hawa, hawa, hawa. Yeah, you know, like it's like they just look slightly different things and then they mean completely different.
I mean, I think what's so fascinating about being a poet who is bilingual or trilingual or what, you know, whatever, is that you're really thinking about words and then using words in a way that people who have one language like me, or people who maybe aren't poets, don't, like bilingual people who aren't poets, don't necessarily think about. But I was like wondering as I was reading this, like, are people in your family who are bilingual, do they also have these kinds of thoughts and like struggles with language? Or is it something that like you think is unique to people who are writers, poets?
That's interesting. That's interesting. I mean, I think like, there is a code switching in terms of language and even emotional code switching that happens for most people that are bilingual, you know what I mean? And most people that are like bilingual and bicultural, where like you are probably having some sort of like tension point with the different languages in different ways. And there might be like, you know, like I like very much feel like my parents' daughter when I speak Arabic. And, so I think you don't need to necessarily be a poet, but I do think there's something, I agree, I do think there's something to be said for like, if you are already interested in language, you're probably going to be, even like musician, like you're probably going to be unpacking and breaking language in a different way. And then like, again, like seeing how you can put it back together.
Yeah. Cause I'm just thinking like, I know there are words in English that like have multiple meanings that are different, but I never think about those things. I'm never like, there's these, like, I can't even think of one off the top of my head. You know, like I can only think of homophones or whatever. Like, but I can't think of, like, I'm like read and red or whatever. But I'm like, those are the same words.
Right. These that sound the same. That's
But like, I can't, cause I just don't think about language in that same way. And I'm sure people listening who are writers are like, here's 20 words that are like that in English. And so I was just thinking like, if you've got multiple languages and multiple uses of words, and like all the in idiosyncrasies of language, and that's your medium, like
that's
a lot to work with.
100%. Yeah. No, I think there is something to be said for like, then you're diving in even more. Like you just have, I mean, it's like anything. It's like you have a larger surface area of things to cover, you know, and you have even more tools in your arsenal to reach out and like, pop in an Arabic word. She does this a lot, like pop in an Arabic word in a poem. You know what I mean? Like that, like the vocabulary one and the multiple choice format of it is brilliant because it does kind of show you how like, this word that seems the same, sounds the same, et cetera, can completely change the context of like the use of it. Mm-hmm. Okay. Completely change the context of the sentence, depending on the use of it and depending on which one you're kind of leaning into.
Yeah. And like, it makes them, I mean, the meaning is totally different, right? Cause she goes on to say Abdel Halim was left empty or was left full.
Exactly. That's like the multiple choice. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's like Fayrouz is looking for vehicle or Fayrouz is looking for fuel.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I loved this poem. I was like, this was a poem where I was like, okay, I think I can hang out here a little bit.
It's a beautiful poem.
Like, I feel like I'm in already.
No, it's one of the most like, it's gorgeous. It's gorgeous.
And then of course, like language ties to home and like feeling like belonging, feeling like if you have a mastery of a language, you belong to at least like at least the language, but a group of people, a community. And I think like, you know, like we said before, she's really, I feel like she feels sort of out at sea a lot in this book, like in between two places.
Yes.
Like less displaced and more just like out of place.
I resonate with that because I think she does. I think in reading her book, it's like she's often speaking of things not within them, but she's speaking of things as witness to them.
Yeah, like she's like outside.
I was just going to say exactly, like in order to witness, you have to be outside of a thing, you know, and she's kind of doing that in multiple ways around multiple, like, and again, around multiple places, like what you earlier were talking about, like, you know, like her as someone that like is in Sudan and her as someone that's in like Maryland, you know, like both, like in both places when she's writing about either or both, it's like, you do get the sense of, I mean, this is what I think it is to be multicultural or bicultural anyway, right? Is to like, to be inhabiting borderlands so fully that like you maybe are never fully in a thing. Mm-hmm. You're maybe always like writing from the vantage point of the person like observing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm mixed. So my mom is white and my dad is black. And I think like for a lot of people who are mixed like me, like in America, there's something about feeling like being between two places as well. It's different because like I'm black American. So my black family has been here longer than my white family, but still feeling like you're kind of, there are these borders that are different than, they're of not course. Governmental borders, but you know the difference as soon as you step into a store or a neighborhood or whatever. And I think that maybe that's like part of the reason that I resonate so much with this collection, but also your collection of like trying to find where you fit in and like where you can drop in more fully or where you remain out and kind of observe. And I think that's like I'd never considered my own like racial duality in conversation with sort of like this physical, like
totally. I mean, I don't like, I think that makes perfect sense. I'm not mixed. I'm not part black. I'm not part white, but I can imagine that like, yeah, there are certain places in this city. There are certain places in this country where you enter it. It is like entering a different country. Mm-hmm. There are different, like, there talk about like code switching, right?
Yeah.
There are different, like, there's different language for different things. There's different ways of expressing emotion. Certain ways of expressing emotion. I mean, like, that's the trope of like the, you know, the angry black woman, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, there's like, these are these sort of like microaggressive, like, you know, ways of enacting violence against people is like whittling them down to these sort of things is, like there are certain spaces where if you go in and you show a degree of emotionality, you know, like that's like, oops, you just broke some unspoken code about what it's like to be in that space, you know?
Yeah.
And if you're in a, you know, like, I'm, so it's like, yeah, I think that's the thing about any sort of demarcated identity is that like, if you inhabit it only in some ways, mm-hmm. you know, or only partly or only whatever, or if it's like, or if you inhabit it fully, but you're also inhabiting another one fully, which I think is probably a lot of people's experience. Yeah. And like, you are going to move through it in a very different way.
Yeah. I think it's just, it's so interesting. I have never thought about my own like mixedness in relationship to people who like are immigrants or like come from another place to America and feel like that pull. But for some, I think like just this conversation and these collections and reading them sort of back to back and thinking about them, that's something that came up for me for the first time of like, you know, and I think maybe like, again, totally different experience, but also something you could pull from is like people who are queer and like are kind of like, it's all the same sort of code switching, trying to figure out where you fit and don't fit, but it's different kinds of communities for different reasons. But I do think like, and I think it's just like probably a really human feeling too, regardless of identity, of like feeling pulled between two things in its most broad, basic sense.
I think that's right.
You know, not to like be like, this is universal, because that's not what this is at all. But I do think that that like pull.
Yeah. And also, I think what is universal is that all, I mean, she writes this in one of her early poems. I'm going to try to find the there's a line that's really beautiful. Oh, yes. It's the first poem. At the very end, a woman died and everything wants a home. Like everything wants a home. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like everyone, like even if not everybody knows what it is to code switch or like what it is to move through neighborhoods or move through cities or whatever, like everybody knows what it is to want to belong and to be safe and to feel like you like you are in a place that is yours, you know, that calls to you, that you belong to. Like I think that is maybe the most human thing in the world. It's probably the most animalistic thing in the world.
Yeah.
You know, like that's what we all are seeking and that's what we all want with each other, with places, with et cetera. So like, yeah, I think on that level, I think it is, there is a universality to it.
Yeah. Okay. Let's take a quick break and we'll be right back. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated. And AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number smart beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first 3 orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Okay, I want to talk about the musician.
Abdul Halim Hafiz.
Yes, you say it much better than me. Did you know who he was before you read this collection?
Yeah. He's like an Egyptian. He's like a famous
Egyptian. So I had never heard of him. And I put the music on immediately as I was reading the collection because I just wanted to get the vibe. Mm-hmm. I was really into it. I liked it. I listened to a live recording. The crowd Amazing. Was so in. I was like, wait, I'm into this.
Very. Yes. I love watching old Arabic recordings of like live music. It's amazing. Yeah.
And I mean, for me, these poems were my favorite part of the collection because I really? Love celebrity worship culture. I mean, I live in LA. Like, I love this idea. Because I grew up, my dad was much older, like I had an old dad, and he always was having us listen to like old school music. And so I also related to her, like having this crush on this man who was dead like 10 years before she was ever born. I don't even know if it was an actual crush, but like this idea so of being obsessed.
But yeah, the way you kind of love. Yeah, it was a sort of love.
It kind of reminded me of like... of like this Al, do you know the Al Green story where his like wife threw grits at him? It's a very famous story.
What? No.
He was like a monster of a husband and she threw hot grits at him. But it was like, or also like Marvin Gaye's story where like his father killed him very tragically, mm-hmm. very tragic story, but like still these like lores around.
Like the mythology around the person. Yes.
Around the person from our parents' generation.
That's
right. Like that you become obsessed with the things that your parents play. And
because
like
they've yeah. Yes, they're exposing and like you to it all yeah, the time.
And you pick mm-hmm. up these little things and you're like, maybe I'm sort of in love with Marvin Gaye. Like his voice is beautiful. Like and he has this tragic story and people loved him. And his version of the national anthem is like that version of the national anthem. I hate the national anthem, but his all-star national anthem is like one of my favorite songs of all time.
Can I tell you, I've never heard it.
Oh, it's he did it for the NBA All-Star game in like 1981, maybe.
I'm going to make a note of this.
It's really good. I will link to it in the show notes. It starts off a little, you're like a little bit like what's going on. But by the end, he like hits it and the crowd starts clapping. Like it's
really?
Like a, and the national anthem is, America's national anthem is truly a dud of a song. Like I am not in, like this is not my personality, but this is one of my favorite songs of all time. It's the only on 4th of July, a holiday that I love because I love hot dogs. I do nothing Hilarious. Americana except for listen to that song and eat hot dogs. Like that's it for me. But it is the one time I feel like I'm like, I want to wave a flag. Like,
I love the
it.
Image of you just being like, this is what this country is to be.
Yes, it's hot dogs in
this
one
Marvin Gaye version of like, yeah. That's hilarious.
Yeah. But so I could totally relate to her like, and I don't know, she just in the poem, I don't, maybe you can explain what's going on, but it feels like she feels really young in the poems. Like it feels like it's from a younger voice, almost like a child. Like you can, or like yeah, you can I mean, feel I think, the child's longing.
Right. I mean, I think she probably actually was quite young when she was writing these poems because this was a while ago. And I think she started working and publishing pretty young. But yes, there is a part of it that's also just like, how do you, like one of the things that she's also doing in speaking to Abdul-Halim or like in kind of speaking like in whatever in referencing him in these different pieces is like also speaking about her like blackness.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And also speaking about brownness and also speaking about what it is to like live in these different spaces. It's so like, I mean, I remember the like, would you care like this piece on page 18, it's from Callback Interview for the Position of Abdul-Halim Hafiz's Girl. And it goes, would you care to address the treatment of Nubians in Egypt and in the Arab world at large? Look, black as I am, I still feel like the girl from the song. I mean, I remember walking through Cairo, Khan al-Khalili, you know, the big bazaar. Anyway, I remember the men were calling from their shops, hey, Nile girl, hey, Aswandam, and I never got the context, so I'm not sure if they were taunting, but I mean, they looked at me and thought of water. Does that answer the question? Like, there's something about, like, her, like the way she writes about... Like she's writing about him, but she's using him as an entry, a portal mm-hmm. into all of these other things around like her skin color, the story of her parents, the story of love, the it's just, it's brilliant. It's really brilliant. Yeah.
And you said that he was known for like liking or like talking about darker skinned.
Well, he I think there were a lot of songs of his that were addressed to like Asmarani, like so, which mm-hmm. is just sort of a generic whatever term for yeah for someone that's dark skinned.
Interesting. And she does talk a lot about like also being black, but like maybe not being black. Like she has that again duality between the two, like not being black, but being black, but not in the same way as like other people. Like there's like, she's definitely,
she's also navigating, I think, also like Arabness versus Africanness, and like, yes, the ways that that overlaps, and the ways that like the verses is really something that's put upon, like the positioning of those two things as being different than each other is something that's like placed upon that dichotomy from something outside of her. She's not doing it. She's just like kind of like, you know, dealing with the fallout, right, of the fact that that's happening.
And like trying, yeah, to figure out where, again, where she fits in, totally, between.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I really liked all of those poems.
The Singer, like, poems.
Yeah, I did. I think, yeah, I also, again, I like repetition. I like,
yes,
getting to, yeah, come, yeah, back to, yeah, this thing. And I liked seeing how she changed it and like how she kind of goes on the journey through the story. And then obviously, right, I had to look up his death because he died pretty young of like, mm-hmm, some like liver disease from like a parasite or something. It was something, he had been sick his whole life, it sounds like, from like a, some sort of parasite I think you get in like water. And he was diagnosed young, and then he died in his 40s. And then people were killing themselves over his death.
Yeah, it was really, he was like, I mean, it's like the sort of, it's, I mean, talk about celebrity worship, like the, like, it's like the Elvis or the whatever. Yeah, it was, yeah, really profoundly.
Yeah. And that I think was in like 77, maybe, I think was the year. I can't, I did look it up, but now I can't remember. But so I would like, again,
When he died,
I think he was 47 or 48 and he died in the 70s.
God, he was young.
Yeah, he was young. He was young. It's funny when you like look back at pictures though, because everybody like in the 70s looks like way older than like
it's
now.
It's so funny. I know.
People, I'm always like, wait, you look like 60. But I think that's just like the look. Like ladies, like women, their hair is like,
they also,
old,
I was
school,
just going to say the bouffant. Yeah, like the hair.
Yeah,
and
like
the
big glasses and stuff.
That's right.
But she, that, I guess we should go there. She talks about love and romance and then like gender roles and like obligation to gender. There's the poem about the last night that like Marvin Gaye plays. Speaking of Marvin Gaye.
Yes.
The last night Marvin Gaye's heard, the last time Marvin Gaye was heard in the Sudan. And it's, she's like refers to her mom as my mother, my not yet mother, and then her father as before he is my father,
yes,
which I loved.
Yes. My not then, yet mother. Yeah.
And then she ends it with, through the final notes of the song, and tonight my parents do not meet, which I also, yes, love. Just like such, yes, I love a twist ending of a poem, right? You,
yeah,
think,
exactly,
it's going to be like they kiss.
Because you think
and
they're
like,
going to,
they,
like, I was just, yeah, going to say, you think they're going to come together.
Yeah, this is how her parents meet. This is the beginning of her story. She's like, nope, but tonight they
don't meet. There's a lot of like the mythologizing of the family. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm, like, I think there's, mm-hmm, a lot of that of like, there's a
the
lot of poems that touch upon. Exactly. Like there's a lot where there's, yeah, the grandmother, the parents, the story of the father, like leaving, but like, it's just, yeah, it's so, oh man.
And she, there's a poem, the poem about her grandmother called Bride Price, where she talks about married off at 17.
I love that one.
Married off at 17 to a man who saw her in a photograph. My grandmother, hair heavier than night, cream-colored girl, spilled from her mother's lap, thinks I'm taking too long. And then this is the line where I was like, oh, we're talking about like gender and all this stuff, where she says, we outlive our beauty. It is currency we trade with men for their names, for a house, for someone to belong to.
Beautiful.
So good.
So good.
I feel like what I also like about this poetry collection, again, it's because A, I think I understand some of it, but B, I don't feel like she's trying to do more than is necessary. Sometimes I feel like poets, I get caught up because I'm like, they're doing too much. And I feel like you can just say somewhere to belong to. And I'm like, I'm with you, girl.
And that's it. And we got it. I mean, this is, so my favorite is the, or one of my favorites is Self-Portrait with Yellow Dress. Can I read it?
Yeah. What page is it on? I like to read along.
It's on 29.
Okay.
Self-Portrait with Yellow Dress. And sometimes we do not die. We are born to a body dressed in black and do not wear it to a funeral. We live forever. Our mouths open and a song falls out thick with the saxophone syrup. And all our dead in the ground make the land ours, and all our missing fathers make us everything's child. Today, I am not dressed for a funeral. I wear the yellow dress and laugh with all my teeth, and my lost ones are not lost to me. They live in the wind that gathers my skirt. Today, this is my country. I say their names, and all the holes left behind, shaped like black girls and black boys, are lit up by hundreds of faraway stars. Today, I woke up and was not dead. And tomorrow might be different, but tomorrow does not yet exist. So I hold my mother's hand and kiss the brown valley between each knuckle. My brother opens his mouth to laugh, and the light pours in through the gap in his teeth. I press my body to a man that I find beautiful and sway to a song that knows us. I live forever with my feet in my grandmother's lap. I live forever by the water with the sun spilled over me. Remember me this way. And when they come for me, play the song I love into the space I leave behind.
Mm. Why do you love that one?
It's so musical. I love how you have no real, there's something about like when writers, you know how you're saying earlier, it's like my dash has sort of told you where to take a breath. Mm-hmm. I love how you kind of don't know where to take a breath in this one. Like you could go by the line breaks, or you could, but that doesn't always work. Right. So it's mm-hmm. like, and all our dead in the ground make the land ours. No, you're going to say, and all the dead in the ground make the land ours, and all our missing fathers, and all, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just the movement of it and how like it just swoops into the like the most granular details and then swoops back out into this like beautiful, like just I love it.
Yeah. We went back and forth a bunch to pick a poetry collection to do. And you sent over so many titles, and I was like nervous that I wasn't going to understand anything that you sent because some of them seemed really hard. One of them was about nature, and I was like, I can't do nature because I'm not a nature girly.
That's so funny. Yeah.
I was like, I gotta. And so I don't. Do you know Nate Marshall and Jose Olivares?
Yes. Yes. Okay. I know Jose. I don't know Nate Marshall.
Okay. So they're best friends, but I have invited myself to their friendship. So I joke that we're the three poets because they're real poets. That's and I'm Liz. Me. But That's I was Liz. I was sending them all the collections you were sending, being like, will I understand these? Will I understand?
Were they picked this one?
Well, a few of them I knew for sure I couldn't do. I was like, I feel like I'm not going to be ready for
not
these.
Not going to do it. Yeah,
and then you had sent two. I can't remember what the other one was. And I was like, what do you guys think between these two? And they were like, well, have you read Safia before? I was like, well, I've read some of the first book. They're like, well, if you like that, you'll probably like this one.
Okay.
And so that's why I picked it. But I want to know why you wanted to do this one.
I think it's a book I've taught before. It's a book. You know how like there are books that let like just leave an imprint on you. And mm-hmm. then they're just one of the first ones that come to your mouth. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, or to your lips. And like, this is one of them. Like, I think she touches on so many of the themes. Part of the reason I picked it is because I knew we were going to be talking about some of the stuff that was in the poetry collection that I had just published, and just in general writing, like what it is to write about identity and what it is to write about place and what it is to write about like moving between different kind of liminal spaces, both literally and sort of emotionally. And this felt like a perfect addition to that conversation, because she's like writing about that stuff so brilliantly.
Yeah. I think like something that I think, you know, in this moment in 2024 that, you know, cannot be ignored is like this conversation around Palestine and what's going on there, mm-hmm. and the genocide, and also like the ways in which the Sudan has been sort mm-hmm. of like is going 100%. Through similar things and has been erased, and like not or totally. People, you know, are throwing it in as an afterthought.
Absolutely.
And so for me, I think I don't know, there's no point there, but that is something that like I was thinking about a lot as I was reading both of these collections, right?
Yep,
like in
totally.
Conversation and the ways that like being from a place that is auditioning for empathy, as you might say.
Totally.
Impacts the way that the artist writes, you
100%,
100%,
know? And like the urgency of writing about that place, you know what I mean? And like getting eyes on a place and keeping eyes on a place, like what's happening in the Sudan is like, it's, yeah, I mean, it is barely getting any airtime. And to your point, it's often tacked on as an afterthought, you know?
Yeah.
And Safia actually is a really good example of somebody who's such an excellent ally mm-hmm. and who really models what it's like to be able to speak to the causes that are sort of like near and dear in that, like, this is a place where she's from or her family's from, but also like never forget that it's all intersectional. You know what I mean? So when you're speaking about the Sudan, you're speaking about Palestine, you're speaking about these other places, like that it's all really one thing, you know, and that what we have to do is be consistent in our like discourse around these different causes.
Yeah. a few weeks ago on the show, we did this book called The Unclaimed, which was about dead bodies that are unclaimed in the United States, in Los Angeles. But one of this, it's two sociologists, and one of the guys, his work is about the hierarchy of death and how like some deaths are like Princess Diana, right? Everybody cares. Everybody cries. That's, it's in the media versus, you know, there are people who, you know, people who are unhoused who die and nobody thinks of them at all. And
that's right.
And I asked him a little bit, I was like, does this also apply to like groups of deaths, like wars, right? Like the ways that we think about whose deaths are valuable politically, right? And he was like, absolutely. He was like, yes, definitely. And I'd never really thought about that, but now I can't think about the news of what's going on in Gaza or the Sudan or the Ukraine or whatever and think about who does get the attention and why.
And how do we write about their deaths?
How do we write about it? And how do we feel about it as the consumers of this writing?
That's
like, how do we feel implicated? Do we feel like we're the good guys because we feel badly for these
people? Exactly. And is it just like the perfect victim? Is it one of those things where it's like, you know, the correct victim is one that can be pitied, you know what I mean? Like versus one, like, I think there's a lot of stuff around that. And I think also just around like, you know, how do we speak of like, you know, do people die or are they killed?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Are they young people or are they children?
Children.
Like, there's really like, I mean, this is a lot of stuff is being done around this and research is being done around like headlines and how people are spoken of when they belong to different groups and how that contributes to dehumanization.
Yeah. I mean, and like kind of to the beginning of this conversation, it is sort of like a journalistic poetry, right? What word are we choosing to use? And I sometimes catch myself using a word that is less accurate because I'm trying to like vary up my vocabulary, you know, like sometimes I'll be like, oh, you know, like so-and-so was killed, like JFK was killed or like JFK died. And I'm like, well, I actually mean he was assassinated.
Was assassinated.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But like sometimes you just like use the word that comes easier but like, and so you feel, you don't notice it when someone else does it necessarily.
And you don't notice it when like a massive entity that like a publishing entity does
like
it.
The New York Times does it.
Like that sort of thing is actually very mindful. Like that's being done.
Yeah.
Like, with intent, you know.
Right. But we forgive those things sometimes, I think, because we're like, oh, well, I would make that mistake. And it's like, right, but I'm not the New York Times. Like, I'm Tracy, and I'm just like trying to talk about JFK for a long time. And I just said assassinated three times in a row. And my English teacher would be like, you're using the same word. I'm trying to vary the vocab. But I do think about like all, like another thing that, speaking about like the perfect victim.
Yes.
Or like the, you know, the one who deserves most empathy. A friend of mine, she just visited LA and bought this book about Latasha Harlins. And that's one of my personal obsessions. And she was the young girl who was killed by a Korean shop owner that predates the Rodney King riots, but was one of the things that was like very pivotal in LA to escalate to that point. But a lot of people don't remember that story. And I was saying to her, what's so interesting is that Latasha Harlins really was the perfect victim. She was like a teenage girl and she was paying for her juice and the woman thought she was stealing it and she pulled out a gun and she shot and killed her. And I was thinking about all the ways that like Black women are the perfect victim, like Breonna Taylor, and they still don't get the attention that a quote, I mean, and I'm saying perfect victim, all this in air quotes, but like a non-perfect victim like George Floyd, who does get the attention, even though he's like a less sympathetic person, like that it doesn't always follow, you know,
the
narrative
that,
taught, the rules that were told, she was
That's
an EMT. They went into her house. She was asleep. She should be a perfect victim.
That is exactly. There could not be more of a victim.
Yeah.
By definition, a victim.
And so I think, all of these things, I mean, that's why I love reading. It's like all of these separate things that I think about coming together, like through these poetry collections.
Coming to life. Exactly. Yeah. No, I think that Safia does that. I mean, she's doing that around, again, Blackness and brownness, and she's doing it around America, and she's doing it around Sudan, and she's doing it around like intergenerational, like all the things we carry intergenerationally, the things we lose, the things we inherit, the things that we basically like pass down to one another. I mean, it's really like remarkable actually what she's doing.
Yeah, I think so. And I, again, like, I feel like I got a lot of this collection, but I also felt like I was working too. Like it didn't feel easy.
Yeah, you know.
Like I felt like I had to think and like pay attention, but also that it was within
my grasp. But it's accessible, right? It feels accessible actually. Yeah. Because she's also just a story. I mean, she's such a good storyteller. So a lot of the poems are her, like, yes, she plays around with like no punctuation. And so you maybe have to like kind of like reread a few lines every now and then. But a lot of them are like relatively straightforward, like just like narratives and, and sort of like family mythologies that are being told.
Yeah. Okay. We almost are out of time. But before we get out of here, we always talk about the title and the cover. What do you think of the cover? What do you think of the title? We didn't really talk about what the January Children are. But for folks who haven't read the book yet, it's a generation of Sudanese men who were lined up by their lovely colonizers. Shout out to the colonizers for doing it wrong every single time. And by height. And they were given ages based on their height. And everyone's birthday was assigned as January 1st. And then the year depended on your height. So this generation of Sudanese
was known
as the January Children.
That's right.
So what did you think of the title and the cover?
I think the title was wonderful. I think it helped frame something. Like it helped frame, like it immediately is, it's like not a fact that I knew. So immediately it like, I learned something and it helped frame that the book was always going to be like, you know, that it was going to be held up by the history and the narratives around Sudan and, and how this poet like intersected with them. And I actually love the cover. I don't know who the artist is.
Did you look into that? I looked it up. They're on the back. Their name is Dar Al Naim. And they are a Sudanese artist. Their Instagram is fantastic. I will link to it in the show notes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Their art has changed a lot since this. Like, They were doing like a lot of like black and white brush strokes more recently. But I got to like, I was scrolling through and seeing like some of the older stuff and then some of like, it was really cool to find them. And they seem to be youngish, like maybe in their 30s or 40s.
Amazing.
Yeah. So I do really like this cover.
It's very striking.
Yeah. What I don't like about the cover actually is just the heading that's like African-American poetry book series. And like, I don't like the yellow block at the top, but I do love the art.
Right. The art is beautiful.
And I do love the cover. I mean, the title, I think it's super evocative. As soon as you understand what it means, you're like, oh, this is juicy. And I think it, you know, obviously ties in to what we were talking about before about like the generational parts of this book, right? Like, because I think her grandfather was a January child.
I think, yes. Her grandfather was a child. And also, like, and like I'm saying, like, it sort of frames it. So it's like, that tells you something about what this, you know, what happened to these people and this place under the occupation of the British. And then you like zap forward to the future where there's this like diasporic daughter of this place. Yeah. You know what I mean? Having all sorts of like experiences in Cairo, in America, in Sudan, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah. Ugh, this was so great. Do you have anything else you want to say about this before we are done?
No, just I like really recommend the book. If people haven't read it, please read it.
Yeah, I recommend it too. For all of you people scared of poetry like me, you can do this one. I believe in you. I definitely think you can do it.
You can
it's
do
not,
it. Yes,
it's not going to scare you. And for those of you who hate long poems, these poems are not that long. Some of them are very short.
Yes.
Because last year we did Ross Gay and a lot of folks, myself included, struggled with the length of some of the poems.
The very length. Okay, yes.
They're very
that's
lengthy.
Fair. That's fair.
It's like
that's
a 100-page book with like 7 poems. Some of us were struggling. And by us, I mean mostly me. So everyone, January Children, if you haven't read it yet, read it. If you have read it and you want to read more, Safia's book that came after is called Girls That Never Die. Right. We have Hala's book, The Moon That Turns You Back, that just came out. Yay. She's got 4 other poetry collections, 2 novels. She's working on a memoir that she hates writing.
Yes, it's true.
Hala, thank you so much for being here.
Tracy, this was a delight. Thank you so much for having me. I really, really had a great time.
Me too. Everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. All right, y'all. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you again to Hala Alyan for joining the show. I'd also like to say a huge thank you to Nina Leopold for helping to make this conversation possible. And now our announcement of our May Book Club pick is No Name in the Street by the one and only James Baldwin. 2024 marks James Baldwin's centennial year. And we want to commemorate that by reading one of his books. And for this one, we've picked a memoir about his childhood in Harlem and the subsequent experiences throughout the country. You will have to listen on May 1st to find out who our guest will be for our May 29th book club episode. If you love the show and want inside access to it, head to patreon.com/thestacks and join the Stacks Pack. Make sure you're subscribed to the Stacks wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts or Spotify, be sure to leave us a rating and a review. For more from the Stacks, follow us on social media at the Stacks Pod on Instagram, Threads, and TikTok, and at the Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. This episode of The Stacks was edited by Christian Duenas with production assistance from Lauren Tyree. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tagirigis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.